This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Imani Owens about her new book, Turn the World Upside Down, Empire and Unruly Forms of Black Culture, Black Folk Culture in the U.S. and the Caribbean. Dr. Imani Owens, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. I really enjoyed the book. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. But Dr. Owens, I wonder if you could just begin the interview just by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm Brooklyn born and raised, Brooklyn stand up. You know, I had to get that in there. And both of my parents are historians. They're both academics. And so in my life, I always knew that the life of the mind could be a possibility to pursue. But when I was younger, I always thought that I would be a visual artist. I actually went to LaGuardia High School for music and art and the performing arts. And so I thought, you know, I was going to go to conservatory and take that path. I also was trained in classical piano. So that was another area. But I couldn't shake sort of this love of literature that I had. And so I ended up going to Rutgers and studying with the great Cheryl Wall, who really is the person responsible for encouraging me to pursue that path and to go to graduate school. And the idea that I didn't have to give up sort of these other interests I had in music and art, you know, I could write about it all, and I could really reckon with the way that the writers I was interested in, like Langston Hughes or Noel Hurston, were immersed in the arts themselves. So I graduated from Rutgers with a BA in English, minor in psychology, which I could talk more about. And then I went to Columbia and got my PhD in English and comp lit. And the comp lit side of it is actually rather important, because that is what became the foundation of my method for looking at works in different languages and just having kind of the institutional support to do that. I was also part of the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia. And that is where I continue to kind of hone my interest in music and just be in conversation, interdisciplinary conversation with scholars who are thinking about it, whether it was from the perspective of musicology, or I think we had some cognitive scientists come in one time. And so the Center for Jazz Studies was really important to my just sort of intellectual formation. So from there, you know, I'm speeding along, but know that there was a lot of like thinking and struggle in this. But so I got my PhD from Columbia. And within that, I did a scholar in residence at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. That was just a time to just finish my dissertation in a different setting and just be supported by people who were really invested in my success. And then I did a postdoc at the Center for African American Studies at Princeton. So I'm fortunate in my career to have had a lot of time to be able to do the kind of work that I do, which is very archival, requires a lot of sort of travel and a lot of thinking about how to put all the different pieces together. So I think that's where I began in telling you about myself.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, what brought you to this particular project?
I think I have to go back to my Brooklyn upbringing. So of course, you know, this project began as a dissertation and all of that, but it was really my growing up in Brooklyn in a community that was a Black community that was people from the South and folks from the Caribbean, right? In fact, I think Flatbush, Brooklyn has like one of the largest Caribbean populations outside of the Caribbean, right? So I was thinking about these intersections between African-American experience and the experiences of Caribbean migrants pretty early on. And it was something that, you know, I became curious about why this was often a kind of submerged history that many of the figures that we talk about that are kind of these icons of, you know, African-American history have Caribbean ancestry, like, you know, Malcolm X, Maya Angelou singing Calypso and things like that. So part of it was just becoming interested in the submerged, you know, histories of figures that we already know. And then when I went to college and graduate school, in college I studied French, and I began reading these Francophone Caribbean writers like Maurice Condé and Guisson and others. So I knew I was interested in that. When I came to Columbia and I studied with Bryn Edwards and Bob O'Mealy and Farrah Griffin, and they really supported my, you know, eagerness to find out, well, we can always know more about the Harlem Renaissance, but what was happening in, say, Haiti? What was happening in Cuba around this time? And I took a class with Bryn Edwards that I think was called Poetics of the African Diaspora or something like that. And I was introduced to Nicolas Guillen, who is a Cuban, became this almost poet laureate of Cuba, who I write about in the book. But then they kept mentioning this writer named Eric Walgren. So every time I would read sort of like an anthology of the Harlem Renaissance or a critical account of just like the literary scene and like who was going to the parties and stuff like that, Eric Walgren would always pop up. And I'm like, well, who is this guy? So it turns out Eric Walgren was one of the writers, like many of them, who was heralded during the Renaissance, but who sort of kind of disappears later. And he was born in Barbados, and he migrates to Panama with his mother at a young age during the construction of the Panama Canal, right? So this is from 1903 to 1914. And the bulk of the labor being done on the canal, which is a United States project, But most of the hard labor was done by these Caribbean migrants. And so Walrin is a part of this migration, and he ends up sort of growing up on the canal zone and documenting just what life was like there. And one of the things that he documents was how dangerous and deadly the labor was, all of these explosions. They had gotten yellow fever somewhat under control then, but that had been responsible for a lot of the deaths when the French were trying to build the canal. And you know, just things like, you know, falls from high places, and you can imagine, because they are cutting a canal from the Caribbean Sea to the Pacific Ocean, right? So out of that experience of being actually a journalist in the Panama Canal Zone, he comes to Harlem and gets involved in the literary scene there, and is often compared to Gene Toomer in terms of kind of the richness of his writing, his interest in sort of the everyday folk. And he writes this book called Tropic Death that is about all of these deaths that he's been documenting in the canal zone. And so I'd seen Eric Walrin be mentioned, but I'm like, well, why don't people talk more about this guy? You know, it's fascinating. At the time, Tropic Death was out of print. So Bryn Edwards, of course, he reached in his drawer and gave me like a Xerox copy of Tropic Death. And that became sort of the kernel for what would become the dissertation, and the main concerns of the dissertation, which were not only like how did, you know, Caribbean writers contribute to the Harlem Renaissance, but how does thinking about those writers kind of change our framework, you know, geographical and otherwise, for thinking about what the main concerns of Black modernity were, you know, for writers during this time. And one of Walrin's main concerns is just the specter of U.S. imperialism, right? The U.S. building the canal in Central America, having all of these Caribbean workers engage in this dangerous labor, paying them in silver while the white workers were paid in gold, right? So basically bringing Jim Crow to the canal zone. And sort of what that meant to structure our understanding of this historical moment, the first few decades of the 20th century, around an understanding of U.S. empire and the difficulty often that African Americans had with sort of reckoning with that, right? So what does it mean for our own claims to citizenship when we have to reckon with the fact that of the United States, right, is now the major imperial power in the hemisphere. So it really began with, or really kind of crystallized around Eric Walrin and Tropic Death. But then later on, I started reading more and more of Sylvia Winter. And so the title of the book actually comes from a Sylvia Winter quote where she is talking about dancers. She's talking about during the period of slavery, but the Christmas Jean Canoe Festival in Jamaica and how that persists to this day, and the ways in which the dancers cultivated not only crops, but cultivated this rich relationship to the land and to the earth. And through their rituals, through their songs, through their performances, they turned the world upside down, right? They imagined a world in which they were on top, right? So this kind of inversion of colonial power. And to me, that seemed like an appropriate figure for what all of the writers in this book are interested in, is that project of turning the world upside down.
And so what is folk culture? How is this typically thought of, and how does your project sort of reinterpret the idea of what folk culture is?
So it's a tricky term, right? And so throughout the project, I was like, Do I really need to use it? We all have these kind of fraught terms in our writing that we are always trying to reevaluate. But I kept coming back to folk culture because that's, in fact, the term that the figures in my study are using to talk about, say, Black vernacular speech, music, rituals, dance, sort of these everyday practices of Black folk, right? But it has many different meanings, right? So in our current lexicon, I guess, we might say that something is folksy, meaning down to earth, or we might refer to folk music, which we could understand as the kind of roots music, right? But in the era of the Harlem Renaissance, I think it's useful to understand folk culture in the context of the Great Migration, where Black people are moving to urban centers mainly, but not exclusively in the North. So there emerges this idea that they are leaving something behind, right? Their folkways, the way they talked, their music, their rituals, and that these things that had been left behind could be inspiration for an authentic, usable past that could inspire modern art. And so I'm paraphrasing Elaine Locke here. Elaine Locke is understood to be really, you know, one of the midwives of the Harlem Renaissance, he was often called. And he publishes this anthology, The New Negro, in 1925. And so sort of his ideas about what constituted the old Negro and the new Negro became very influential, right? This kind of binary that the old Negro, otherwise known as the folk, right, were mainly a Southern people, mainly located in rural areas, right? This idea that they had these great sort of cultural productions that could inspire writers, right? And so scholars of the Harlem Renaissance have been rightly critical of this gesture of sort of saying like of this kind of geographical binary where the South often appears like it's in this pre-modern time that is divorced from what's happening in the North. Of course, we know that that's not true. We've come to understand the South as a site of modernity and is in its own right. But part of what I argue in the book is that this more complicated understanding of the South, or what Locke calls the old Negro, is not an invention of contemporary critics, right? It was always there. So if you look at the people that he anthologizes in the New Negro, like Hughes, Hurston, Toomer, Walrond, these are all people who are in the book, by the way, the idea of folk culture that they are trying to formulate or theorize is quite a bit more complicated than this kind of romantic ideal of, you know, authenticity and sort of like this almost static idea of folk culture, right? That it's not subject to transformation and development. But in fact, if you look at someone like Hurston or Hughes, and the way that Hughes is thinking about blues music as this sort of product of Black modernity, right, and how it encapsulates all of this social commentary, this historical commentary, right, we get a much more complicated picture of folk culture. And so I began looking at sort of these historical flashpoints. And there are a few of these in the book. So I look at the construction of the Panama Canal and the stories that emerge around that. I look at the U.S. occupation of Haiti. I look at sort of ongoing U.S. involvement in Cuba, right? And all of the sort of cultural production that was commenting on these events in real time, right? So this idea that folk culture is not a thing of the past is something that these writers take up and they feel is very powerful in a way that they're actually leaning into the modern and saying something very profound about the way that everyday folk navigate historical change.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
And so let's talk a little bit about the organization of the book, right? So which you just spoke about a little bit. So you organize the book into two sections. What does each section sort of focus on? And what was sort of the thinking that you had in this organization behind the sort of separation of the two parts?
You know, that's an interesting question, because the separation was there in my mind, but didn't come like in the book until very late in the process of production, when I realized, oh, actually, my thinking has crystallized around these two ideas. So the first book, slip of the tongue, but that might actually be accurate. These could have been two different books. But the first part of the book is called Writing the Crossroads. And that was actually the title of my dissertation. And I'll talk a little bit more about the figure of the crossroads, too, because it becomes really important in the first chapter, especially. It was really the first part of the book is really about writing, you know, about different genres of writing, the short story collection of Wall Rent, the hybrid book of Jean Toomer's Kane, which is poetry, skits, you know, dramatic sketches. And then Zora Neale Hurston and Jean Price Maher writing these ethnographies about Haiti around the time of the U.S. occupation of Haiti. In the first half of the book, I'm really interested in how these writers experimented with these literary genres and sort of opened them up and broke out of what might be understood as these master narratives that that we often have about modernity and folk culture. So the second half of the book, though, there's still writing there, because I look at the poetry of Nicolas Guillen and Langston Hughes, but I'm also looking at just the history of recitation of the poetry, right? So I look at this 1946 production of Cuban Evening, the poems and songs of Nicolas Guillen, and that was a Catherine Dunham production. And so I become interested in the ways that not only the print culture of the poetry, but the ways that it was recited and circulated. And I look at a figure called Eusebia Cosme, who was specialized in declamation. And declamation is, it's not just recitation, it's theatrical. It involves sort of music, it involves costume changes, right? And what I argue in that chapter is that these performances of poetry are just as much a part of the literary history of that work as, you know, the written poems. And it gives us sort of a different understanding of the figures that are familiar to us, like Langston Hughes, when we think of Langston Hughes sort of like putting on his dinner jacket and and reciting, you know, translations of Nicolas Guillen's poems. We know that he at least recited a couple of them in Spanish, and Guillen often like playfully poked fun at Hughes's accent, you know. And so these little details, I think, are important to understanding what it means to perform the archive. And that's the title of the second part of the book, right? So then I have that chapter on Afro-Cuban poetics, and I also have a chapter on Sylvia Winter. And I look at her early kind of career as a dancer and also a playwright. mainly to satisfy my own curiosity, right? When I discovered a while ago that she began her career in Bosco Holder's dance troupe, and Holder is a Trinidadian choreographer, I was like, wow, you know, this seems to be just as important to thinking about her intellectual formation as her early essays. Let's learn more about this. And so in performing the archives, the title of that section is just as much about my own method as it is about these performances themselves, in the sense that I had to think about what it meant to kind of reconstruct these performances from fragments in the archive. And that in and of itself is a kind of critical performance, right? It involves a lot of speculative thinking, but it also involves the imperative to argue that these performances are important and worth engaging with, even in all of their kind of opacity.
Absolutely. So let's get into these chapters a little bit deeper then, right? So like you said, chapter one sort of focuses upon sort of the crossroads of works that views both the American South and also the Caribbean, right? So can you talk to us about how your reading of these works sort of broadens what you call the geographical contours of the Harlem Renaissance?
Yeah. And it's almost, you know, to go back to Eric Walrens, right? I was interested in, on one hand, this recuperative gesture of simply saying, well, the Caribbean writers beyond Claude McKay, who's very important, but I think we often stop there talking about Caribbean contributions to the Harlem Renaissance. But folks like Walrens, another writer, Eulalie Spence, who was a playwright, not only sort of contributed to this conversation that was already happening, but they changed the conversation, right? So think about a work like Tropic Depth that is published at the height of the Harlem Renaissance, but kind of turns our gaze elsewhere, right? To the Panama Canal Zone, but to this real engagement, not only with the Caribbean, but for what it meant to think about the relationship between the U.S. and the Caribbean at this time of sort of increased military intervention, right, into the Western Hemisphere, changes the conversation about, you know, what were the key questions that shaped Black modernity. But at the same time, so I'm thinking about Walrens, but I'm thinking about this comparison, how he and Jean Toomer were often sort of listed together as two of these just young, promising, experimental writers. I'm like, well, there has to be something more to that, right? In one of Walrens' first stories, there's this quote saying, we're in Barbados, right? But he's saying, you know, it was not Sepia, Georgia, but a backwoods village in Barbados, right? So he makes that comparison, or that that gesture of saying it was not this, it was that, right? But knowing that the description of the backwoods village in Barbados really resembles some of the descriptions of just the southern landscape in Jean Toomer's Cane. And so I began thinking about those moments in Cane, right, where we have sugar cane, which is, you know, abundant in the Caribbean. And we have sort of rum and cassava and all of these things that I think critics had sort of read as just a kind of Toomer's kind of primitivist touch, you know, he's just referencing these things. But actually I'm like, well, this kind of locates us or connects us to the Caribbean. So it was not just the case that Walrens and these Caribbean writers were thinking about these connections, but that these writers of the South were also thinking about them, right? And so what does it mean to, for instance, expand the geographical contours of the South into, you know, the Caribbean Sea. And some of the writers did this quite literally in terms of their travels, right? So Langston Hughes, he had this kind of journal that I saw in his papers at the Beinecke Library at Yale. And the journal is titled Journey South or something like that. But then he lists all of these locations, you know, Georgia, et cetera. But then he says Haiti and Cuba, right? But these are part of his journal titled Journey South, right? And so thinking about, of course, thinking about the global South, but thinking more specifically about this regional connection between the South, the Caribbean, and to a great extent, and thinking about the Panama Canal Zone, Central America.
Wonderful. And so chapter two, then, it looks at these responses to U.S. occupation of Haiti that happens in sort of the early 20th century. So how does this chapter help us to sort of understand folk culture as an alternative mode of occupying space in the face of sort of imperial occupation?
Yeah, well, I mean, let me tell you, this chapter was difficult to write because, so this chapter centers around Zora Neale Hurston's Tell My Horse, which is her ethnography of travels to Jamaica and Haiti. The Jamaican section is the shorter section. She spends most of her time talking about Haiti. This is often regarded as one of Hurston's, really her worst book, is the way that people, they try to put it more diplomatically than that, but it's regarded as one of her most problematic because of the way that she kind of says the U.S. occupation of Haiti, right, which took place from 1915 to 1934, which they completely kind of restructured the Constitution. They it was often this sort of cultural assault on voodoo temples, which were raided, and many of the Marines just brought back these kind of sacred artifacts just as curiosities to the United States. It's also where I would argue we have the origins of sort of zombie culture in the United States. So taking this idea of the Haitian idea of the zombie, which was really someone who was reduced to non-being by labor, and often labor that was overseen by the United States in the form of the corvée, which was this obsolete law that required, you know, citizens to do work on roads that was similar to the work done in enslavement, right? So all of these things that happened during the occupation, and Hurston comes in 1938 and says, you know, maybe the occupation wasn't such a bad thing. And she has this section of the ethnography called Rebirth of a Nation that is really almost talking about the arrival of U.S. Marines in this kind of almost this image of a white savior, right? So this is regarded as like one of Hurston's more embarrassing political stances. But then you have the sections of the book where she has these beautiful, beautiful descriptions of Haitian art, and in particular of spirit possession, in which spirit possession becomes sort of this way of speaking truth to power, right? And so there are these kind of what the critic Daphne Brooks would call these dissonant gestures, right, that tell a different story than the one that Hurston seems to be telling, you know, about the occupation. And so part of the work of this chapter was figuring out just what to do with this text, because there are a few critics who have written very smartly and I think fairly about it. But what I became curious about is, were the larger conversations that Hurston was part of, or that were even going on, right, among Haitian scholars themselves, is that's often the missing piece, right? So it's not just what Hurston and people like James Weldon Johnson, who wrote much more sympathetically about the occupation and self-determining Haiti. It's not just about what these U.S.-based writers were saying. It's also about the conversations going on in Haiti. So I turn to Jean Pricemont, who is this towering figure in Haiti, right? He was an ethnographer. He was a physician, a philosopher, and becomes this kind of leading voice of the Haitian elite in the 1920s. And he publishes an ethnography called L'Ainsi Parle l'Oncle, which means so spoke the uncle, right? The uncle being sort of this figure of Haitian folklore, right, in storytelling. And so one of the important arguments he makes in that ethnography is that voodoo is a real religion. It's a valid religion that is worthy of study and it's worthy of respect. And it's not simply a psychosis, which is the way that possession had been talked about, you know, prior to that. But I think the most essential argument he makes in that book is that it's an anti-imperial statement, right? That in fact, look at the wealth of knowledge production that has come out of Haiti, right? We are not in need of being saved. And certainly not in need of being saved by the U.S. And if we don't sort of take a hold of this rich history, you know, we are further at risk of being kind of subsumed and absorbed by this imperial power to the north. And so when he wrote this, the occupation was still going on, of course. And so there's an urgency to it. And there's, you know, as a result of this, there's this kind of flourishing of intellectual production in Haiti and beyond, because Pricemont is the person who is kind of responsible for showing people around, like James Weldon Johnson when he comes to Haiti, right? Or like Melville Herskovitz, right? So he also facilitates this whole age of Haitian studies in which U.S. researchers are coming to Haiti very interested in studying culture. And so they often came through him. So I find this to be incredibly important because the origins of what we think of, and this is part of the argument of the chapter of diaspora studies emerging in this kind of, in Pricemont's kind of anti-imperial stance towards the U.S. And the need to sort of reinvigorate that. And so once I put Hurston in conversation with Pricemont, and they both, where they would both agree was in their assessment of spirit possession, and so it's what it meant to sort of occupy the spirit or the place of the spirit occupying the body as this sort of alternative form of occupation against U.S. occupation. And so in that chapter, I'm interested in where Hurston and Pricemont agree and also where they diverge. So it made it a very interesting chapter to write.
It was very interesting to read. I would say that as well. And so chapter three, as you mentioned, sort of starts the second half of this book. And it looks at the 1946 production of Cuban Evening, the poems and songs of Nicolas Guillen. So can you tell us what's the argument in this chapter? And also, how does this chapter sort of further our understandings of sort of like Black folk culture?
Yeah, well, this chapter was fun to write. They were all fun to write in different ways. So I'll just tell you about how the chapter developed. That in my dissertation, at first, it was a chapter about Nicolas Guillen and Langston Hughes. And Langston Hughes and Ben Frederick Carruthers, who was a professor at Howard, as translators of Guillen's poetry. And so the original sort of topic and argument of the chapter was about sort of the importance of translation and the development of transnational poetics, right? And so, but, you know, I began to realize, you know, as I was editing this for the book, I was like, well, who was around these people? Like, what was the larger circle? Because often, I don't know if I actually say this in the book, but often the Nicholas Vien and Langston Hughes pairing is often talked about as this kind of bromance where it's like, you know, these two kind of stood alone in this, you know, pioneering of, you know, translation of Afro-Cuban poetry. When in fact, they were actually, there were a larger circle of interlocutors around them that are equally important. And some of them are women, right? So we already know about Gustavo Orisha in Cuba and Ben Frederick Carruthers as Hughes's collaborator. But there was also this declamadora called Eusebia Cosme, who came up in Cuba, was a little younger than Hughes and Guillen, but was certainly their contemporary. And she delivered these declamaciones, these theatrical recitations of Afro-Cuban poetry. And I should clarify that in Cuba, Afro-Cuban poetry or poesía negra could be any work that was on Black themes, right? Not necessarily by Black writers. So there is part of the work of the chapter is to think about what things translate and what things don't, you know, across national boundaries. And that's one of them, is that we might think of poesía negra, Black poetry in the United States, as poetry written by Black people. Whereas in Cuba and in much of Latin America, it didn't necessarily mean that. But she does recite Nicolás Guillén's poetry. Nicolás Guillén, who is a poet of African descent in Cuba, and wrote these poems about son music, using the rhythms of this music that incorporated the, you know, bongo and many other sort of African derived instruments, right? And it was a kind of street music. And so I begin to ask the question about, you know, well, what role did Nicolás Guillén's poetry play in her repertoire, right? And to my surprise, she had a radio show on CBS in the 1940s, in which it had a large, it was, I think, coming out of East Harlem, but it was broadcast, you know, across Latin America. And she recited the poetry in translation of Langston Hughes and Paul Laurence Dunbar, in addition to Nicolás Guillén. And so in many respects, she had this very broad audience, right, that it's kind of hard for writers to have on their own. And so part of what I argue in this chapter is that in many respects, she's just as important to, she was just as important to the kind of spread of Nicolás Guillén's poetry and the sort of audience interaction with these poetics as, you know, any writer was. And so, I mean, the challenge of this chapter, and also the thing that was fun about it to write, was I was in the Langston Hughes papers, I think, and I found this program from this 1946 production of Cuban Evening, the poems and songs of Nicolás Guillén. And on this program, I see that it's a Catherine Dunham production. I see Langston Hughes. I see featuring Hughes and Eusebia Cosme, but I also see Eartha Kitt, you know. I also see Candido, who's this famous Afro-Cuban musician. I see, like, all of these interesting people who, you know, I was like, what was this about? And so the challenge of this chapter was, I'm trying to reconstruct a single evening in 1946 based on really, you know, I started with this program and I began to find other fragments, such as in correspondence from Catherine Dunham to Langston Hughes talking about what he's going to be wearing, which was a simple dinner jacket. Correspondence about Eusebia Cosme wanting to have an additional dress rehearsal because she was very meticulous about things, particularly coming from the theater, right? And what that sort of, those performance practices, how they were different from what Langston Hughes might have been used to with, you know, poetic just readings of his own poetry. It's like, no, we're going to have dress rehearsals, you know. Just these little sort of tidbits, right, that when I was writing my dissertation, I would not have known what to do with, because there was this notion that, you know, anything that didn't really fit into the argument, you got to scrap that because you got to finish this chapter, right? And so in writing the book, I felt like I had a little bit more space to say, no, I'm going to follow that thread and I'm going to see what I can make of it. And the result is this kind of what I feel is like this momentous event, you know, happening in 1946 and happening before Langston Hughes publishes Cuba Libre, which is his translation of Guillen's poetry. So what I argue is that you can see in the drafts of the poems that Hughes is translating, the changes he made after this performance and in preparation for this performance. So in what ways did the performances themselves kind of shape what later became the written translations of Nicolas Guillen's poetry? And also Cosme's sort of incredible influence, you know, in this sphere of Afro-Cuban poetics, which is often talked about as if there were only men.
And so chapter four focuses on Sylvia Winter. And as you've already spoken about, it focuses upon her work as sort of a dancer, a playwright, and a radio actor in the 1950s in London. You've told us sort of why you focused on this early career, the fact that it was so interesting to you. What specifically was sort of interesting about this sort of early portion of Winter's career? And how does it sort of sum up this exploration that you have into this like Black folk culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to me because it allows us to place Winter as in part of this historical moment of West Indian writers, dancers, artists, creators who are coming to London at this moment, right? Who are part of what began called as the Windrush Generation, right? So in 1948, this was the name of the ship. That's why it's called the Windrush, right? A ship arrived with many Caribbean migrants on and sort of opened, you know, a floodgate of Caribbean subjects who are often understood themselves as British subjects, right? Because this is pre-Jamaican independence, for example. And so they're like, well, we're here, you know, and it's interesting because the poet Louise Bennett has this poem called Colonization in Reverse. And she's talking about this migration from the Caribbean to the metropole and almost like this insurgent gesture. It's like, we're here. You said we were British subjects, you know. We're here to reap the benefits. We're here to take advantage of opportunities. But most of all, we're here to be amongst each other, right? And so I think it was crucial to place Winter as part of this. But interestingly enough, so she does this interview with David Scott, which everyone should read. It's around 90 pages, but there's so much in there. And she talks about being in London during his time, and Scott is asking her, oh, were you hooked into this network of writers that we all know, you know, were in London at this time? And she says, no, I was actually more linked into the dancers. I was part of this Bosco Holder's dance troupe, and that was far more my world. She's adamant about correcting that, right? And so I wanted to take that gesture seriously and thinking about dance as not only, you know, this thing that she did before she became an intellectual, right, but part of her intellectual formation. And she talks about taking classes at King's College in London and going out from her lectures and going basically across the street to Bosco Holder's dance studio, right? And so this movement back and forth between sort of the academy and the dance studio is one that, you know, I felt was symbolic of what Winter does in her own work. And especially in that first, one of her early essays, Jean Canoe in Jamaica, which is an essay about dance. I would even argue that it's it constitutes performance theory. And she talks about just the power of dance, and especially in carnival rituals, because the whole idea of carnival was that things were turned upside down, things were inverted, right? We're imagining a moment in which the world is different from, you know, from what we experience every day, right? And she says, well, this is a revolutionary gesture. This is revolutionary imagination encapsulated in dance. And so I thought that it was important to see Winter not only theorizing this, but practicing it as a dancer herself. So part of the chapter discusses Winter as a dancer, and then the other part is discussing her plays, some of which were performed on stage, but many of which were on BBC radio. And I see these plays as her kind of grappling with some of the kernels of some of the ideas that would expand later on in her work, like, you know, quite simply, what does it mean to be human? What is our relationship? What is the relationship between the Black body and the earth or the landscape? And so she has a couple of plays and short stories that were aired on BBC Radio that deal specifically with, you know, imagery of cultivation, or even sometimes what it means to be a landowner, but to have that land sort of overgrown with weeds. They call this ruinate in the Caribbean, which means land that was meant to be cultivated, but now is, you know, overrun and overgrown, and Winter finding some potential in ruinate, right? In the wildness of it all. And so I think that these early works are very informative of where she would eventually go with some of her scholarship. And I just think it's interesting to imagine her on radio, like dealing with this early technology, and which gave her an audience, right? Which broadcasted to the Caribbean, so was consumed by everyday folk. And I think about sort of what listening practices that they may have had, right? And so this chapter sort of culminates the book in many ways, because Winter, in at least the 60s and 70s, starts to explicitly talk about folk culture. And what she begins talking about is dance, but she's also talking about, you know, storytelling. She's also talking about spirit possession very explicitly. And so the idea that she wants to, and Yeah, I get the phrase reinterpret folk culture from Winter, because part of what she's doing is trying to articulate the urgency of reimagining folk culture now. By now, I mean when Winter is writing, in the 1960s, in which you have all of these sort of nationalist movements that are taking up, you know, local folk culture. And she's like, well, we need to be careful. We need to be careful in how, in not sort of erasing the subversive potential of folk culture. We can't just use it as, you know, a blunt instrument to become powerful or to become dictators, like we saw in Haiti with Duvalier, who took up all of the trappings of, you know, folk figures in the way that he presented himself. And so part of what Winter is trying to argue is that we have to have discernment and sort of like this critical lens when we look at folk culture. But it's so urgent to reinterpret it now because it represents sort of the very heart of self-invention, right, for Black people. So we still need it, right? So in many ways, the book comes full circle from Winter in the prologue, sort of turning the world upside down and how that becomes a framework for what all of these figures are doing. And then going back to sort of her own practice as a dancer and as a playwright, and how important the creative life was for her in formulating her later theories.
And what sort of audience did you imagine for this work?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, as I was writing this book, I was like, you know, I want my friends to be able to read this. Like, that's not the answer that, you know, often that the official answer that you give. But I wanted them to find something familiar in it. One of my best friends, her grandfather or great-grandfather worked on the Panama Canal. And actually, I didn't know that until I started working on this project. And she was like, hey, did you know, did you know that my great-grandfather worked on the Panama Canal? And so I think that those conversations have been the most rewarding. And I've been having a lot of them here, you know, in and around the New York area. I think, so part of the audience that I want for this book are people who feel personally connected to the histories that I'm talking about. Of course, scholars of the Harlem Renaissance, and so I live in Harlem right now, so scholars of the Harlem Renaissance could mean just people walking down the street, because they'll tell you, like, Langston Hughes used to live there, you know, on 127th Street. I live on a historic street, you know, right now, that I'm sure, you know, someone could tell me about, right? So scholars of the Harlem Renaissance and many of the ways you can interpret that. While writing this book, I had the opportunity to travel a lot, to go to the to go to Haiti. I went to the Faculty of Ethnology, which was founded by Jean Preisman. I went to the Fundación Nicolás Guillén in Cuba. I went to Panama City, the Museo Afroantiano there. And so these are some of my audiences as well, quite literally in presenting my work and sharing what I was doing with these organizations that have been so important with in perpetuating these histories. So I would say that these are my central audiences, both scholarly and, you know, our everyday intellectuals.
And what do you want readers to take away from this work?
I think Part of what I want them to take away is just the richness of what has been produced in, you know, the Western Hemisphere, but specifically in this this flow of culture between the U.S. and the Caribbean. But I also want them to take away that this idea that what we know of today as diaspora studies really emerges not only in this reckoning with the afterlives of slavery, but this reckoning with U.S. imperialism and colonialism and Jim Crow. So this continued need to be critical about the U.S.'s involvement in the Caribbean, ongoing involvement in Haiti in particular, and what is our responsibility to sort of know the nuances of that history and to develop our politics around, you know, a real concern for you know, our mutual survival. So that's what I would like people to take from it.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Owens, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I have one last question for you. What are you working on now?
So I actually like this question. I am working on, so coming out of this book, which is, which was my way, you know, this first book was my way of talking about writing, but also talking about music, dance, storytelling, all of these non-written forms as well. The second book is going to be on the concept of rehearsal in Black literary performance culture. So it's called Rehearsal, Black Performance and the Practice of Freedom, or something like that. And I came up with the idea after reading James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues. And there's this scene in it where Sonny is practicing the piano almost like obsessively. And the people that he's staying with, at first, you know, they encourage it because it's keeping him out of trouble, right? But it almost becomes a kind of torment because his practicing is so repetitive, so obsessive. They say it's not like living with a person, it's like living with sound. And I became fascinated with this idea of practice as something that is so crucial to Black artistic formation, but also Black survival. But the idea that practice or rehearsal can also be this difficult thing, you know, that it can be painful. And so rehearsal really is like about this practice of anticipation and what it means to sort of be in the moment and being maybe anticipating a performance, but what it's really about is being right there in the present. I sort of changed my thinking about this during the pandemic, when we really were kind of in a holding pattern, and what it meant to do something right now as a rehearsal for Black freedom, right? That was important in its own right and not just about the outcome. And so I'm looking forward to really digging into this project next.
Yeah, that sounds like a great project. And I'll definitely look out for it. I hope that the listeners will as well. Well, Dr. Amani Owens, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the book as well. Take care.